Today is Wednesday, August 7th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up.
But he's very cautious in what he says Russia is prepared to do. He is making the point that it is not Russia that's going to initiate this arms race, that, you know, Russia is not going to develop or deploy INF-range missiles unless the United States does.
That was Russia expert Thomas Graham on Russian President Vladimir Putin's statement that a new Russia-U.S. arms race could be looming. It's all on today's International Edition. U.S. President Donald Trump is in Dayton, Ohio, one of two cities he is visiting today that have been hit by recent deadly mass shootings. Before he left the White House, Trump said he thinks we are going to come up with something that's going to be really, really good on gun reform. But he said there is no political appetite for a ban on assault rifles, as some are calling for. The president denied criticism that his statements contribute to the mood of hate that has unleashed repeated shootings by lone gunmen, more than 250 so far this year. To the contrary, Trump says he thinks his rhetoric brings people together. The visits highlight the ambivalence of some who question whether Trump, because of his often incendiary anti-immigration rhetoric, has the legitimacy to heal the grieving communities, especially in the heavily Hispanic El Paso, just across the border with Mexico. Some residents and politicians in Dayton and El Paso, Texas, asked Trump not to visit. But El Paso Mayor DeMargo said he will welcome Trump to the city. In a speech on Monday addressing the tragedies, Trump cited a variety of reasons for the massacres, including mental illness and violent video games, and called for the passage of a so-called red flag law that authorizes local authorities to confiscate firearms from a person deemed by a judge as posing a risk of violence. Well, the man suspected of killing 22 people at a Texas shopping mall allegedly posted an anti-immigrant manifesto on a social media platform. The platform he used is popular with those who hold to an ideology of white supremacy. Professor Jesse Daniels at the City University of New York studies white supremacists and other hate groups. She particularly has looked at the online presence of such groups. She spoke with VOA's Kate Pound Dawson about her research.
My research actually goes back before the rise of the popular internet. So I was looking at first at white supremacist literature in printed newsletters, and then watched as these groups that I was studying in print moved onto the internet, really in a lot of ways before most people did. So they were early adopters of technology and what I call innovation opportunists. In other words, they were they saw an opportunity in technology in the early days and jumped right on it to make the most out of that new technology that they saw as useful for spreading their ideology. And indeed, it has been very useful for spreading white supremacist ideology. And part of what they've done has been very smart about the way that they use technology. So it's not just, I mean, so they know that it's not just about broadcasting, right, which I think it requires a lot of sophistication in terms of how you use different platforms to connect with people and to spread ideology. As to your question about whether the numbers are growing, it's a really, really difficult question to answer because there's a lot of confusion about it, sowed partly by the white supremacist groups because they want you to believe that their numbers are growing, but there's a lot of evidence to suggest that they are in fact growing. Perhaps not at the rate that the white supremacists would like you to believe, but there are more and more people who are going online and finding this kind of ideology appealing.
How is this combated in the cyberspace? How do parents, teachers, law enforcement, how do they deal with this issue online?
Yeah, I think that there are lots of potential solutions. I think for and it depends on who's combating them. I think for parents, it's very, very important to stay tuned in to what their children are looking at online. You know, we used to, in the early days of the internet, say keep the computer in the living room where you could keep an eye on it. But now most young people are using their phones to access the internet. So I think it's important for parents to figure out ways to pay attention to what their young people are looking at when they're connecting online. And I think one of the biggest, places right now that white supremacists are targeting young people is through video games. Now, when it comes to law enforcement, there's not really a good record of law enforcement, particularly in the United States, of taking white supremacy online very seriously. There's a real hesitance here in the United States to take any kind of white supremacy online seriously, because the default assumption is that all of that kind of speech is protected by the First Amendment. That's actually a misunderstanding of the American First Amendment. But the other thing that we know is that law enforcement here in the United States has been defunded from taking seriously white supremacy, either, you know, on the ground or online. And so there's not really a strong record of law enforcement dealing with this. But I think that parents and educators have a real opportunity and a real possibility of addressing these with young people by talking to them about these ideas. And I think that in some ways the ideas of white supremacy are what are most dangerous here. And we as parents, as educators, as concerned citizens need to get much smarter about the way that white supremacy is infiltrating our everyday lives. And we see this coming from the current resident of the White House, who's, you know, fomenting this anti-immigrant, anti-black sentiment from the White House in ways that are dangerous. You know, I mean, this is what now the third shooter who's referenced the president in their manifesto. You know, so it's really at the, I think, at the level of ideas that we have to start taking this seriously and combating it.
That was Professor Jesse Daniels, who has written extensively about how white supremacists use the internet to advance their ideology. She spoke with VOA's Kate Pound Dawson. Among the top stories in the world, the UN has increased its aid appeal for Zimbabwe to $331.5 million to deal with food shortages affecting more than half its population. North Korea has released photographs of leader Kim Jong-un watching the country's fourth missile launch in less than 2 weeks. Pakistan says it will expel India's ambassador and suspend trade amid growing tensions over the disputed Kashmir region. The annual Hajj pilgrimage in the Islamic holy city of Mecca begins on Friday, and China is warning the U.S. and its allies not to deploy intermediate-range ground-based missiles in Asia. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition. The world took anxious notice this week when Russian President Vladimir Putin threatened the possibility of a new nuclear arms race with the United States. Putin was responding to U.S. President Donald Trump's decision on Friday to let America's 1987 Intermediate-Range Nuclear Forces Treaty with Russia lapse. The State Department claims that Russia continues to violate the agreement. Russia denies the accusation and calls upon the U.S. to negotiate. To help explain the dispute over the INF and analyze the geopolitics involved, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Russia expert Thomas Graham, a distinguished fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York.
Putin has been talking about this for some time, since the United States raised the issue of withdrawing from the INF Treaty back last fall. He's always talked about the INF Treaty as one of the keystones of the global arms control regime, and that eliminating that treaty would open the way to an arms race. But if you look very carefully at the statement that he released after the U.S. withdrawal. It does, again, say that there's a possibility of an arms race because of the U.S. action. But he's very cautious in what he says Russia is prepared to do. He is making the point that it is not Russia that's going to initiate this arms race, that, you know, Russia is not going to develop or deploy INF range missiles unless the United States does. So it's going to follow the American leader and in a way throwing the onus in the United States court. Now, of course, in saying this, he overlooks the fact that as far as the United States is concerned, Russia has already violated that treaty. And that was one of the reasons that the United States gave for withdrawing from the treaty, that Russia has, in fact, over the past several years, developed and deployed a missile that fell within the range that was prohibited by the INF treaty.
Why do you think Putin said this? Do you think it's sort of he's posturing for his domestic constituency, or do you think that he's just sort of stirring the pot? I mean, he's not necessarily a friend of peaceful equilibrium with the United States in recent years.
Part of it is directed at a domestic audience, and that is that, you know, Russia is a great power. It sees itself, at least in a nuclear realm, as the equivalent of the United States. I think second is directed towards a European audience to raise concerns about what the United States is doing, to present the United States as reckless, in the hope that this will undermine the cohesion of the NATO alliance and also undermine the cohesion of the transatlantic community. Again, goals that Putin has been pursuing for some time.
Okay, so you're not overly concerned, but you're guarded.
No, I'm not overly concerned about the INF treaty. The bigger question really is the fate of the New START agreement, which expires in February 2021 if it's not extended by the United States and Russia. The administration, particularly John Bolton, has already indicated that he believes it's unlikely that that treaty will be extended. Now, that, I think, has more serious consequences because that is a treaty that regulated strategic nuclear arms, not non-ballistic missiles, and so forth, that I think is important to maintaining strategic stability between the United States and Russia. It also has a number of confidence-building measures in its monitoring regime and verification regime that are politically important for the U.S.-Russian relationship at this point. If that treaty goes away, then I think the situation does change in a significant way. And it does leave the world without any large and far-reaching strategic arms limitation agreements. It undermines the arms control regime that has built up over the past about 40 or 50 years. So the START agreement is the one that I would focus on as opposed to the INF treaty.
That was Thomas Graham, a Russia expert and distinguished fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. He spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. While the United Nations Refugee Agency says it is alarmed by the Italian Parliament's decision to impose severe penalties on boats and people conducting rescue operations for migrants in the Mediterranean Sea. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The Italian Parliament has approved changes to existing law aimed at deterring private charities from rescuing refugees and migrants in distress at sea. The new law, originally proposed by Italy's conservative interior minister, Matteo Salvini, would impose a maximum fine of $1.1 million on any private rescue vessel that enters Italy's territorial waters. In addition, rescue ships would be automatically impounded. UN Refugee Agency spokesman Charlie Yaxley says the new law is of great concern as it could deter private vessels from helping migrants at a time when European countries have largely ended those life-saving missions.
NGOs play an invaluable role in saving the lives of refugees and migrants attempting the dangerous sea crossing to Europe. Their commitment and humanity should not be criminalized nor stigmatized. Likewise, NGO and commercial vessels must not be requested to transfer rescued people to the Libyan Coast Guard or be directed to disembark them in Libya.
The UNHCR says it is not safe to return refugees and migrants to Libya, where they are arbitrarily detained in facilities under often abusive and appalling conditions. In the meantime, the International Organization for Migration says 49 migrants arrived late Monday in the Italian port of Lampedusa. IOM spokesman Joel Millman says their boat was apparently not escorted by any official authority or any NGO rescue vessel.
We understand 46 of the 49 came from Cote d'Ivoire, that survivors reported that 20 people on board with them when they left the coast of Africa have perished.
The IOM has reported 840 deaths on the three main Mediterranean sea routes in the first 7 months of the year. It says the death toll does not include the 20 migrants said to have died en route to Lampedusa. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is Science in a Minute.
Volcanoes can go from periods of inactivity to becoming restless before they actually erupt. A new study led by researchers at the Carnegie Institution of Science and the Pennsylvania State University suggests some volcanoes on the cusp of eruption can be persistently restless for decades. The researchers found that volcanoes could go through three states of unrest. Signs of their first state of unrest can include a steady release of gas and changes in seismic activity. The second state may include a series of weak explosions. However, signs of the third state of unrest could include the deformation of surrounding landscape and large explosions that include the expulsion of rock fragments. The researchers say their findings could lead to forecasting models for persistently restless volcanoes. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, we'll have an in-depth discussion on child marriage and how girls are valued around the world. Married teenage girls are often physically abused and forced into lives of chores and childbearing. The Worth of a Girl on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Afghan officials say a massive car bomb exploded near a police compound in the capital Kabul today, killing at least 14 people and injuring 145 others. Footage aired by Afghan television stations showed several buildings were destroyed. The Taliban claimed responsibility for the attack against what it claimed was a police recruitment center. The deadly violence comes a day after the Taliban warned Afghans against participating in the September 28th presidential election. Separately, Afghan commando forces conducted operations yesterday against what officials called two bomb-making hideouts of Islamic State in Kabul. American and Taliban negotiators are engaged in peace talks in Qatar. Both sides say they are close to an agreement that would end the 18-year-old war in Afghanistan. The United Nations Human Rights Office is reporting that intensified attacks by a myriad of armed groups in Yemen are having a devastating impact on civilians throughout the country. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the agency's headquarters in Geneva.
Dozens of armed groups, including those affiliated with the Al-Qaeda and Islamic State terror groups, reportedly are escalating attacks in Yemen, adding to the misery of civilians who have suffered through more than 4 years of civil war. Since July 27th, the UN Human Rights Office has verified 19 civilian deaths and 42 civilians injured in Taiz, Saada, and Aden. In addition, the agency says civilian infrastructure, including medical and educational facilities, have been hit and damaged during attacks. UN Human Rights spokeswoman Ravina Shamdasani says groups affiliated with the Houthi rebels allegedly have launched indiscriminate attacks in Taiz. She says IS militants and al-Qaeda in separate assaults have attacked police stations and military camps in Aden and Abyan in the south. She says these actions have triggered retaliation by the Security Belt Forces, a paramilitary force supported by the Saudi-led coalition.
We've received information from multiple sources about arbitrary arrests and detention, forced displacement, physical assaults and harassment, as well as looting and vandalism by the security forces against hundreds of northerners. Reports suggest that the security forces have searched hotels and restaurants, stopping people, demanding their identification, and rounding up those hailing from the northern parts of Yemen.
Shamdasani says such actions breach international human rights and humanitarian law. She tells VOA the warring parties cannot do whatever they wish with impunity because there are rules and laws governing the conduct of hostilities.
rounding up people who hail from a particular part of the country, harassing them, subjecting them to arbitrary arrest, and forcibly displacing them, that is a clear violation of international humanitarian law. Indiscriminate attacks and the use of indiscriminate weapons, such as landmines, clearly breach international humanitarian law.
The UN Human Rights Office urges all parties to the conflict to de-escalate the situation. It says they must investigate attacks on civilians and civilian infrastructure and ensure that perpetrators are brought to justice. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Thank you, Lisa. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. Mozambique's president and the leader of the country's main opposition have signed a new peace deal. The two parties have pledged to end of years of violence and facilitate elections in October. In signing the Peace and National Reconciliation Agreement, President Filipe Nyusi and RENAMO leader Assoufou Momade agreed to peacefully participate in elections later this year. The signing ceremony in the capital of Maputo was reportedly witnessed by five African heads of state, including South Africa's Cyril Ramaphosa. Thousands of Mozambicans gathered in Maputo's Peace Square for the landmark moment. Yesterday's peace pact comes after the two sides signed a related agreement last week to cease military hostilities. The two agreements follow years of negotiations to bring an end to sporadic violence that has persisted since Mozambique's civil war ended in 1992. An estimated 1 million people died in the 15-year conflict. As parts of Australia declare a start to the annual bushfire season 2 months earlier than normal, emergency crews have a powerful new Canadian-built tool to fight blazes, a multi-million dollar modified 737 water bombing aircraft has arrived in New South Wales, the only one of its type permanently stationed in Australia. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The monster air tanker is capable of dumping 15,000 litres of water or fire suppressant. Authorities in eastern Australia say the 737 aircraft will help them to control large blazes or those raging in difficult terrain. It can fly to about 50 metres above the fire zone to drop its load more accurately, and can also carry 70 firefighters. The aircraft was tested in New South Wales last year, and the acting Rural Fire Service Commissioner Rob Rogers says it's a major weapon against the threat of bushfires.
This will be the only large air tanker that's in New South Wales and indeed in Australia. It's exceptional. The ability to be able to go so fast and be pressurised carrying fire retardant, it's the only aircraft that can do that. More than 98% of New South Wales is drought declared, and when the bush is that dry, all you really need is a little bit of wind and fires will become really problematic.
12 parts of drought hit New South Wales, Australia's most populous state, have officially declared a start to the fire season 2 months early. The forecast is for more warm and dry weather between now and October. Authorities are warning that the annual wildfire season is starting sooner and lasting longer. In 2018, crews in eastern Australia were confronted by more fires in the winter months of July and August than the whole of the summer. Australia is well accustomed to nature's extremes. It is the world's driest inhabited continent, and last summer was the hottest on record. Parts of southeastern Australia are among the world's most fire-prone regions. The new air tanker in New South Wales is named the Marie Bashir in honour of a former state governor and daughter of Lebanese migrants. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Thank you, Phil. You've been listening to VOA's International Edition, and you can find us at our website at voanews.com. And thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Nadia Taha, and our engineer, Zeneb Abdelrahman. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and enjoy your evening.